Canto 3, Chapter 28, Text Number 38. Anybody not here yesterday? Oh my goodness. We had a 2-hour class yesterday to review all of that. Listen to the recording. This is Lord Kapila speaking to his mother, Devahuti. He has explained chapter 25. He described devotional service as the answer to the question Devahuti asked, how can I overcome excessive attachment to the bodily conception of life and family life and all of that? So his answer was by devotional service. Then he describes devotional service, what it is. Then he describes how it begins and how it develops. Sadhu Sangha is his answer of how it begins and how it develops. So it's a very nice section, understanding devotional service. And then he backtracks to elaborate description on Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya meaning the analytical study of matter and spirit, categories of matter, how matter unfolds from subtle to gross and grown and on and on and on, and the unfolding of the cosmic manifestation. And we're in a different category. We're in the category of spirit. And the conclusion at the end of that chapter 26 is, and in this spiritual conception, fix your mind upon the supersoul. So meditation is at the end of that discussion. And then the next chapter, 27, is how you do it. How you live your life in the world in that, with that higher understanding of true identity, and lots of valuable instruction for householders. Chapter 27. Again, the conclusion, fix your mind on Supersoul. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says those two chapters are like the big picture. It's Sankhya mixed with Bhakti. And chapter 28 is Ashtanga Yoga mixed with Bhakti. So the fruit of that Sankhya Yoga is fix your mind on the Supersoul, and Ashtanga Yoga is how to fix the mind on the Supersoul. Meditation, which in Satya Yoga is the recommended process for achieving spiritual perfection. So we're hearing in chapter 28 Ashtanga Yoga mixed with Bhakti to come to the stage of unmixed Bhakti. And so the different angas of the Ashtanga system, the eight limbs of that meditation process, are described. We reviewed them. And then long section on the form of the Supreme Lord that one is advised or recommended to meditate upon, and details and details and details and details of the form, and then moves from just the form to the laughter of the Supreme Lord, and how that laughter is so fulfilling that one forgets everything else, and then the absorption of the mind in trance, and what that does to the previous affinity for matter. Because one of the questions that Devahuti asked in previous chapter 27 was, of course, you know, just paraphrasing here, but even if, wait a minute, this process of discrimination or Sankhya, while it's edifying, the soul is inextricably connected with matter. So even if you know that you're spirit, not matter, and there's some detachment that comes with knowledge, still it's implicated in matter. And it's only, you know, that detachment is going to fade because of the implication in matter, and then again one will be engaged in material activity. So how can you relieve the soul from involvement in matter? Knowledge alone is not enough, is what she's saying. And in chapter 27, Kapila Dev says, you're right, knowledge alone is not enough. Devotion is necessary. And devotion has its own potency, as knowledge has its potency. And the potency of bhakti is such that it'll dissolve the mind that implicates the soul in matter. And then he details how that happens. Very interesting. So yesterday we read two verses. That's like a little summary of the section. I'll just reread yesterday's two verses. Thus situated in the highest transcendental stage, the mind ceases from all material reaction and becomes situated in its own glory, transcendental to all material conceptions of happiness and distress, you know, beyond duality, absorption and transcendence, and absorption in the absolute, beyond duality. Pushings and pullings and actions and reactions and the disturbances of the mind subside. We heard in the verse previous to that about like a flame, when oil is extinguished or used up, the flame goes out. But the Prabhupada explains the energy of fire doesn't cease to exist, it's just conserved in some other way. Conservation of energy, right? So then Prabhupada says what that means is the mind that becomes absorbed in the form of the Supreme and thought of the Supreme and the activities of the Supreme and all the different features of the Supreme, that's the flame going out. The disturbed mind ceases, and the spiritual mind replaces the disturbed mind. Fixed. Even in circumstances that are, would normally cause disturbance. And the Sanskrit word is dhira. D-H-I-R-A. And dhira means sober, or one who remains undisturbed. Even when there's cause for disturbance, one remains undisturbed. That person is dhira. That's the mind isn't acting materially anymore. It's because it's acting fully spiritually, and the acting fully spiritually is the spiritual mind, the mind that's absorbed in its healthy, natural, normal state of being absorbed in the Supreme. At that time, the yogi realizes the truth of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He discovers that pleasure and pain, as well as their interactions, which he attributed to his own self, are actually due to the false ego, which is a product of ignorance. That's a big topic, too. And then text 37, because he has achieved his real identity, the perfectly realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving or acting. Just as an intoxicated person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. Lord Nityananda was like that. The demands of the body may still be there, but one forgets the demands of the body, one transcends the demands of the body, when absorption in the Supreme. So this is the Ashtanga Yoga that leads into unmixed devotion. Ashtanga Yoga mixed with bhakti leads to unmixed bhakti. And text 38, this morning's verse. The body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, now what it speaks of the senses, it can mean, you know, the gross physical, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the touch. But more commonly, and in this case, it doesn't mean, you know, the physical instrument. It means the sense of touch, smell, sight, through which, you know, the eye works and the legs work and the tongue works. It's the, you know, the subtle sense. You follow the distinction? Not the instrument, but the power behind the instrument. The body's like a machine. And if, you know, one part of the machine breaks, you can take the part out and put another part in. You drive your car and the alternator goes bad. You go to a shop and they put in it, take out the old bad alternator, put another alternator, and zoom, off you go. It's just a machine part. The body has its machine parts. So what's behind the machine is, of course, you know, the soul, but there's sensual power. Like supposing somebody, it's really simple. What's an automobile? It's the power of locomotion transmitted to a machine. Supposing you don't have an automobile. Supposing you don't even have legs. Well, get in a wheelchair or put a prosthesis on, because the power of locomotion is already there. You need an instrument to exhibit it. That's all. And bodies are a machine to exhibit the power. And then, you know, there's, in the spiritual dimension, there's a spiritual mind, you know, a spiritual sight, spiritual taste, spiritual activity, which doesn't require a material body. When you're focused upon the personality of God, you have a spiritual body. You don't need a material body. You need a material body because of perverted desires to taste something, see something, touch something. So we get a material body for those things. The pratyahara described earlier in this chapter is a process whereby the senses are withdrawn. We discussed this yesterday. The senses are withdrawn means the power. Like, you know, I'm sitting in a chair looking around the room, and the power of senses, I'm seeing this and that and the other thing. But pratyahara is, even this and that and the other thing may be there, that the power of seeing is withdrawn and consolidated. The power of hearing is withdrawn and consolidated. So, you know, sensual power is withdrawn. And instead, everything is then folded into and concentrated into the mind, which is directed to the Supreme, specifically the form of the Supreme, as described in the previous verses. So when that state is reached, there's this incredible detachment from the instruments, the machine. So one may feel hunger, but one, you know, that's something external. You get the idea. I remember one time, this Prabhupada story on this. There were two Prabhupada stories. In Vrindavan, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, his quarters have, when you walk in, you go to visit Prabhupada's quarters, there's like a large sitting room. Now there's also the bed, but that's because that's where Prabhupada left his body, lying on that bed. Before the bed was there, it was just open darshan room. And from time, you know, daily, in the afternoons, commonly, Prabhupada would conduct darshan. And people would come. So something that happened during the festival for the installation of Krishna Balaram, which was an amazing transcendental experience, amazing experience. Many, many, many devotees had come. It was a big event. So in one afternoon they had darshan with Prabhupada. And somebody had brought a little cup of water and they inattentively spilt the little cup of water and didn't clean it up. So when the darshan was over, everybody stood up to allow Prabhupada to walk out of the room into, you know, another room besides the darshan room. And as he was walking, his foot slipped on the water because it's marble floor. It was slippery. And those of you, there's like a little fireplace. There's like the floor, and then this rising, and then a little marble, another horizontal slab, and a fireplace, because it gets cold in Vrindavan in the winter. I've never seen it used, but that's what it's there. And so Prabhupada's foot slipped, he twisted his ankle, and caught himself with his hand. So there was like the swelling in his wrist and swelling in his ankle. I wasn't in the room, but those that were in the room said Prabhupada did three things. He wanted to know who spilled the water, who was responsible for this. And no one wanted to say that they were responsible for it. And, you know, it's negligence. Not whether Prabhupada slipped on it or not, it's negligence. And because of that negligence, Prabhupada was hurt. He didn't hesitate to remind us that we need to be attentive in our everyday dealings, not inattentive in everyday dealings. It's the nature of a devotee. They're very attentive, even to ordinary things, because it's for service to Krishna. So, second thing he did was, he immediately asked for certain herbs and leaves, because he knew how to bring, because it was going to swell, and he knew how to bring the swelling down. And, but he never complained. I mean, he didn't complain about the pain. He complained about the person being irresponsible and inattentive in their service. And I remember specifically that the next day, I asked about it because I saw, as he was seated on the Vyasasan, instead of sitting like this, he was a little distended. And he had this leaf with string wrapped around like a poultice to diminish the swelling. You know, he knew how to do those things. Didn't need a physician. He was the physician. And then a little bit later, he looked at his swollen wrist and looked at his ankle and said, you know, this body is becoming very old and useless, so just get rid of it. Like, with detachment. very, very conscious about service, but very detached from his body. Then another Prabhupada story is Hari Sori was describing to me. Prabhupada had an incredible capacity to just overlook pain, tolerate pain, and like it wasn't even there. Does anybody ever have a toothache? So Prabhupada had an abscess. Like, you know, his abscess means infection. His whole cheek was swollen. And the devotees were saying, Prabhupada, can we take you to a dentist so you can take care of that abscess tooth? Prabhupada said, no, just give me cloves. So he just put cloves in his mouth because it makes it numb, kind of. And he chewed on cloves. And then it went on for some days. And Hari Sori said, I was in life of anxiety because I know how painful it is. And then one day Prabhupada was having his lunch and he reached in his mouth and just yanked on the tooth and pulled out the tooth. Handed it to Hari Sori, said, here, you can keep this, and just went on with his meal. And then another time, Hari Sori had some illness. He had a liver something. I didn't know the details, but I was asking, how are you doing? How's your health? He said, it's getting better. And because he had so much service for Prabhupada, his thoughts automatically went to Prabhupada and said, you know, just starting describing how Prabhupada was able to tolerate so much pain. And he said I didn't know this until he said it. He had one kidney that didn't work at all and another kidney that worked half, which meant that the elimination of uric acid and other toxic things from the body wasn't taking place in his body. And it was largely for that reason that he was having massage, because the toxins would get lodged in his tissues and the massage was to help relieve the toxins from being lodged in his tissues. That's why he did it. It wasn't like, oh, that feels good, let's just do that again. It was for health purposes. And those of us that didn't have that association as Hari Sori had no idea. I had no idea. And those that have kidney problem have shared with me, it's very painful. It's not only, you know, it makes your body stiff and stuff like that, it's really painful. And Hari Sori said, but there was only two times ever that Prabhupada even mentioned it. And one of them, he described, it was, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning in a cold, someplace where it was cold environment, and Prabhupada rang his bell, because that was the system. He had a little buzzer and would tell Hari Sori, it's, you know, please come, there's some service. So 1 o'clock in the morning, rang the buzzer, Hari Sori, you know, threw some water in his face and came running and paid obeisances. And Prabhupada's body was seated straight and with his chadar over his head and over his shoulders and, you know, shivering. And Prabhupada, he said his lips were trembling and he said, I'm in so much pain, I cannot translate. You know, he was always in pain. He just never did anything about it. But, you know, sometimes it was just twice at least. Unbearable, so that he couldn't even do his service. You know, we're a little on a different level, but that's what this is describing. The body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it functions until its destined activities are finished. The liberated devotee, being awake to his constitutional position and thus situated in samadhi, the highest perfectional stage of yoga, does not accept the byproducts of the material body as his own. So what's byproducts of the material body? The fruits of your work. Or children or family members byproducts of the body. You know, the I and mine. If I'm this body, then what's produced by this body is mine. So the liberated soul doesn't have a bodily conception, so they don't have any sense of material proprietorship as they're moving around, navigating their way through material existence, as they're living. No sense of proprietorship. Thus, he considers his bodily activities to be like the activities of a body in a dream. Purport. The following question may be posed. As long as the liberated soul is in contact with the body, why don't the bodily activities affect him? Doesn't he actually become contaminated by the action and reaction of material activities? Questions clear? It's similar to Devahuti's question. You know, you may have knowledge and detachment, but the soul and matter are inextricable. You know, the wave goes up and the boat goes up. The wave goes down, the boat goes down. Aren't you affected? You just, even if you're like Krishna conscious, transcendental? Really? Not at all? Not just like tolerated, but just not affected at all? In answer to such questions, this verse explains that the material body of a liberated soul is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is not acting due to the living force of the living entity. It is simply acting as a reaction to past activities. Even after being switched off, an electric fan moves for some time. That movement is not due to the electric current, but it is a continuation of the last movement. Similarly, although the liberated person appears to be acting just like an ordinary man, his actions are to be accepted as a continuation of past activities. Something like it's described when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was residing in Puri. He was so absorbed in feelings of separation and love from Krishna that he would do his duties as a matter of routine while his consciousness was fully absorbed in Krishna. It's not being absent-minded like we might, you know, the absent-minded professor, because his consciousness is way up on this intellectual platform. He doesn't remember, you know, whether he put two socks on or one or something. The absent-minded professor. This is not just, you know, so attention is completely on the spiritual platform, and bodily functions may go on. There may be some eating or some walking or some this thing or that-ing. And it's not negligence or carelessness or sloppiness or messiness or something like that. Just not affected. Things are moving and one may be doing, but not affected. It's what's describing the standard of consciousness in any case. Very elevated. In a dream, one may see himself expanded through many bodies, but when awake, he can understand that those bodies were all false. Similarly, although a liberated soul has the byproducts of the body, namely children, wife, house, etc., he does not identify himself with those bodily expansions. He knows that they are all products of the material dream. The gross body is made of the gross elements of matter, and the subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, ego, and contaminated consciousness. If one can accept the subtle body of a dream as false and not identify oneself with that body, then certainly an awake person need not identify with the gross body. As one who is awake has no connection with the activities of the body in a dream, an awakened liberated soul has no connection with the activities of the present body. In other words, because he is acquainted with his constitutional position, he never accepts the bodily concept of life. It's this inversely proportionate message, where as much as one is spiritually absorbed, the detachment will automatically follow. As much as one is not spiritually absorbed, attachment, similar to your question yesterday. A very nice discussion on this. It's a little esoteric, more than a little esoteric. Same point in a more esoteric way is expressed in the 12th canto, chapter 5. A liberated devotee thinks, quote, this is right from the Bhagavatam, "I am that Brahman, the supreme state of being. Brahman is I, the supreme position." And the footnote says, means I'm a particle of the supreme. "And considering the lotus feet of the supreme Lord, let me surrender fully unto him." This is in the section where the snake bird is about to bite Maharaj Parikshit. So the commentary. In two verses, the method of deliberation and the bite of taksha are described by thinking, "I am that Brahman, not a person in samsara." One can eliminate lamentation. This isn't Prabhupada's commentary, this is Vishwanath's commentary. By thinking, "Brahman is I am Brahman," one can eliminate the invisibility of Brahman. You can't see Brahman, it's invisible. But by consciousness, by identifying with that which one cannot see, but knowing through knowledge, that is who I am, not this other, and by inference and logic, one can understand, you know, the temporary is not who I am, it's without all the elaborate description of that. I continue to exist, even the body is gone. The baby body is gone, but I continue to exist, so I'm not the body. Yes? Simple. So that which is invisible, one can be still tuned into by consciousness and by this process of meditation. Vishwanath writes, "The esoteric meaning is, I am the spiritual particle of the Supreme Lord, who is like the sun and the sunshine, or sun and sun particle.
you will not see Takshaka biting while pressing his two lips and relishing with his tongue with fire combined with poison. You will not see your body bitten by the snake or the universe, different from yourself. In our case, where our identification is not aham brahmasmi, our identification is gopi bartur kamalayor dasa das anu das. As a spiritual particle, I'm the servant of the Supreme. That's who I am. I'm an eternal servant of the Supreme. The body isn't eternal anything. I am the eternal servant of the Supreme. And by that identification, although one cannot see the soul, one can function on the platform of and in the consciousness of the soul, the natural consciousness of the soul. And then one utilizes the senses and the machine, the body, in service to the Supreme and master of the senses. That's the bhakti process. So this meditation is to help one. I mentioned yesterday in Tapaloka, they do long meditation. And when they're not meditating, it's just, you know, a very few variety of other activities. They discuss philosophy. They take prasadam. And they rest a little bit. Then they go back and meditate. But, you know, those are still activities, and it's still using the senses. The mind is also the chief of the senses, and using that chief of the senses fixed upon the master of the senses, the Supreme. So our lifestyle is meant to be the same. We use the services, senses in the service of the master of the senses. Perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. Krishna's indication in Bhagavad Gita. So just to repeat something from yesterday, the form of the means of achieving spiritual perfection for Satya Yuga is different than the form of how we do that in Kali Yuga, but the principles are the same. The essence is still the essence. Okay, shorter class today. Any comments or questions on this? Yes?
Thanks for the instruction. Yesterday's thing related to the Dada question.
Yesterday's thing?
Saints and trees.
Saints and trees, the evening, okay.
Even the soul is accepting a body as a tree, just like we accept this human body. So is it the natural instinct of the soul to be remain calm because it is never protesting in case of, or is it the limitation of the tree?
It's both.
In that case, we say, okay, we should be tolerant like a tree. Taking the birth as a human nature, we are trying to invoke so many instincts of other forms or species of life. As a human being, whatever the instinct that we have, that is what we'll try to exhibit, whether it's a hatred or whether it's a compassion or whatever it is. So when we try to become tolerant, that means we are trying to absorb the instinct of other forms which we are...
No. That's not correct. We're not trying to absorb the instincts of others. It's natural. Just like this. Natural. What's natural? What's natural is of the soul. That's what's natural. And that which is of the soul is indifferent to what's the configuration of matter today. It has nothing to do with me. The sun is shining or it's cloudy. Now I'm happy, now I'm sad. No, it has nothing to do with the soul. That indifference has nothing to do with the soul. It's not taking on the qualities of some other entity.
Actually, not like taking the quality, I just wanted to put it right, actually.
Go ahead.
I'll fabricate it and I will.
Okay. Okay, I hope you have a good shop where you can fabricate that. Yes?
I have a question from yesterday also.
Okay.
Yesterday morning you were talking about taking shelter of higher character.
Taking shelter of?
Higher character or higher principle.
Higher principles, higher character, okay.
So I was wondering aspire for higher character, is it separate from devotional service?
No. It's a subset of devotional service.
Okay, so if we...
It's part of what devotional service is made up of.
So...
Has you got the answer? Is it clear? It's something that I do for Krishna. It's one of the things that I do for Krishna. I take shelter of higher character. For Krishna. And that means I don't take shelter of lower character. For Krishna. For Krishna. I make that offering to Krishna. Krishna smiles. Thank you very much. Okay? Yes? Yes.
Saints and trees.
You like that one, huh?
Very nice. So, basically we have got a message from the point of giving.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking of point of receiving, like what should be the attitude, and then is it the person who is receiving that favor or mercy, or so what should be his position in accepting, and then he has to reciprocate in giving more, or so most of the time we receive like from parents or from guru. So what should be the reciprocation at the recipient of that?
Depends on you. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on the source. It's, you know, case specific or case sensitive. But before the what you do comes, or I'm just saying, more important even than whether you do this or that is the consciousness behind whether it's this or that. So by that I mean, when you receive, before there's a behavior back, you know, or even like behavior just saying thank you, there's two things: an acknowledgement of the gift as well as the source of the gift. I think I discussed this last time I was here in Detroit. It's flashing in my mind right now. But anyways, acknowledge what it is and acknowledge the person from whom that has come. And then second is a feeling. We shouldn't forget our feelings. The feeling of gratitude. And then arising from the feeling of gratitude comes a behavior. An appropriate behavior, ideally, that expresses the gratitude. A life of devotion is an expression of gratitude. a life of love is an expression of gratitude. And we're receiving something all the time. We're dependent living entities. We're being maintained by the Supreme with not too much gratitude, pretty much just taking things for granted. You know, Prabhupada's explanation of, you know, sunlight and water and air, and, you know, if you're deprived of those things, you know, it's miserable. You can't even survive. We have them, so we take them for granted. And when you don't take things for granted, you receive something, you feel something. You feel grateful. And when you feel grateful, that's a nice feeling. You want to do something. Express your gratitude. So your gratitude can be in words and also in actions. But whether it's words or actions or combination, behind the words or the actions is a feeling. So relationships it's not just behaviors, it's exchange of feelings. Emotion. That's what we want, not just a behavior. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to, what I'm thinking is sometimes the receiving properly is the giving.
Well, can you explain yourself what you mean by that?
Yeah. If someone gives you a gift, and if you acknowledge it and say thank you and appreciate it, it's just that is enough to give back to the other person. It's not that you don't have to do anything, it's that acknowledgement and that appreciation is kind of a gift to the person who gave it.
Sure. Let me add to that. When that acknowledgement and expression of gratitude, expression of thanks is there, something is going to follow. My understanding is that a distinction between behavior and character is behavior is a one-time deal, and character is it stays with you. It's something that's of your being. So, you know, it helps me to understand things just in terms of children. Parents all over the world teach their children to say thank you when they receive something. So that's a behavior. It's a whole other thing for a parent to impart to their child feelings of gratitude. Because when there's feelings of gratitude, it just stays with that person when their body keeps growing. They're just continuing to feel gratitude. And they continue to express that feeling of gratitude in all types of behaviors. Behaviors are resting upon that character. So behavior modification is a lot easier than character building, and there is a distinction between the two. So in the words that you spoke, it's not only the behavior saying thank you, but it's, you know, it's a feeling of the feeling that goes along with saying thank you. And there's a big difference, even when you say thank you kind of mechanically, when you say thank you with real feeling.
Yeah.
And my emphasis is going to the, you know, the feeling of gratitude. The not only the one-time expression of saying thank you will be there, but other forms of that. Because this just happened, it's just a little sharing on this note. Some of you may know Badrinarayan, now Badrinarayan Swami. You certainly know him from California. So I found out yesterday that he's in a hospital in Delhi with, you know, I don't know exactly what. He has this problem, that problem with his health, and he's in the hospital. So we serve together a lot. And, you know, when you serve together a lot with somebody, you tend to like them. You also tend to take the person for granted. And, you know, you tend to know where their weaknesses are because you serve together a lot. You know where their strengths are, but you also know where their weaknesses are. So, you know, we do all of those things together. And so I found I went to the trouble of finding out his phone number and called him. It was in the wee hours of the morning because I figured that was the best time to reach him. And the first time I called, he just shut the phone off. So I know what that meant. He's probably not feeling well. He just shut the phone off. So I waited a while, called again. And the brahmachari, the assistant that's with him, you know, picked up the phone. And I said, "Can I speak with Badrinarayan Swami?" He said, "Who is calling?" He gave my name. And it went, so Maharaj took the phone. And he sounded like, you know, one fifth of his energy was there. It sounded really bad. Like going. Not completely gone, but really far. It sounded terrible just to hear him. And he just, you know, besides the words of the exchange between us, it was really short because I understood I'm just draining his energy and I shouldn't do this. He said three times, "I really appreciate that you called." You know, in other words, the gesture touched his heart. I just, you know, made the conversation really short because he said it'll probably take me half an hour, 45 minutes just to regain my strength from this conversation. His voice sounded that weak. And he said, this is the only call I've taken, and I'm not going to take any other calls. Somebody else came and I had to chase them out because it just seemed so weak. So I said, I'll pass the message on to others to not call you. He said, thank you. Just offer your prayers. So that little gesture, out of all of the, you know, stuff we've done together, will probably remain in our relationship as something that's, you know, more important than all the other volumes and volumes and volumes of service we've done together. Just that gesture. But the gesture was coming. It wasn't just a behavior. Anyway, one of my sisters was sharing with me once, it was our father's birthday, and she noticed that no one had made a birthday cake. So she went to the kitchen and made a birthday cake, and she didn't know what she was doing. She made a cake with blue frosting. And she brought the cake to our father. You know, this weird-looking cake with blue frosting. And he smiled, but she said, I saw a tear coming down the corner of his eye. It wasn't like, you know, a weird-looking cake wasn't what attracted him. It was the gesture out of, you know, regard for him. There's so many examples. So behavior is not the essence. That was my point anyways. The sense of gratitude. So have something else? Yes, Jagatananda.
Regarding the sitting in this class. At the end, after the presentation ended, you made a comment about if we could transcendentally see this the outcome, perhaps for the person who is receiving the fruits of the tree could be a blend different. So my question is regarding...
I don't follow what you're saying that I said. I recall saying giving materially is one thing, giving spiritually is another thing. And the most important is giving spiritually. It doesn't mean we ignore the material things, but most important is the spiritual thing. Because otherwise, give material things and the other person on the receiving end, satisfaction isn't going to be there. And it's not the best of gifts. Go ahead.
So from spiritual caregiving, while we do what the tree did, if we give spiritually, then the person that is receiving, he also, as you said, he appreciates, he gives, he understands the gift he's receiving.
Well, sometimes.
From the perspective of the tree gave everything it had, and at the end of it, the tree could not give to somebody else. The tree was completely chopped down and was finished. So from a spiritual caregiver, it seems that it would be appropriate for me, for us to also take care of ourselves, so then the tree continues to flourish and it can give to others.
Yeah, sure.
Instead of just sort of becoming...
And don't make too much out of it. It's just a story. But that's okay. Yes, and certainly in principle, you can't give what you don't have, so you have to replenish and nourish, along with giving. Both are required. Both are required. Not one in favor of the other or the other in favor of the one. It's both are required. Does that address your question?
Yeah, yes, Maharaj.
Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking because the attention was more we were talking about the greed of the man and the dissatisfaction of the man, but from the person who is giving,
sure.
From that perspective. And then the second question, today while we were summarizing the section, you were mentioning that the earlier chapters of Kapil Dev is teaching about Sankhya, and devotion, and you were mentioning that devotion has its potency and knowledge has its potency. That's a loaded term, I like the sentence. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Even in the context of...
I could write a book on that. I mean, what do you mean, can I elaborate on that?
Meaning devotion, as you were saying, if somebody has a devotion to a person, or gratitude to a person, that could carry him further than knowledge.
Yeah.
Like
you're saying it. So if that's the topic that you like, if that's the comparison, sure, I can speak on that one. Knowledge alone is not enough. Some people may know something. Some people may not know something. And the person that knows something isn't necessarily in a more wholesome situation than the person that doesn't know something. For a lot of reasons. You know, knowing something is not the essence. So, say it the flip side. Bhakti is the essence. That's our understanding. It's the teaching that we've received. And it's the way that we're encouraged to transition our life into, where bhakti is the essence. Then when you take, you know, even the smallest amount of knowledge and connect that with bhakti as the essence, it's very powerful. In fact, from bhakti, the essence, knowledge will causelessly come. Not in an abstract way, in a Krishna conscious way. Krishna will send someone, one who's sincere, wishes to be devoted to him. Krishna will send an instructor. Krishna will send guru on the basis of one desires to know Krishna. One desires that relationship once again, even in a little bit, little seed-like stage. Bhakti, here's another way of saying the same thing. As Krishna is fully independent, bhakti is fully independent. Knowledge is dependent upon bhakti. Bhakti is not dependent upon knowledge. Bhakti is independent. Knowledge is not. Knowledge is dependent. It's an instrument that bhakti can wield and utilize and do something with. But minus bhakti, it's the value is missing. It doesn't stand on its own. It's not independent. So persons who have, quote, knowledge, you know, information, not real knowledge, they have information. It doesn't serve the purpose of knowledge. The purpose is to awaken our original consciousness, and knowledge alone doesn't do that. Knowledge can lead to the best it can do is detachment from what isn't, but it doesn't lead one to what is. Bhakti leads one to what is. It's negation. It's dependent. It's not independent. Bhakti is independent, as Krishna is independent. Bhakti is of the same nature as Krishna's internal potency. Bhakti connects us with Krishna. Knowledge detaches us from illusion, but doesn't connect us with Krishna on its own. Like, there's a set of people, they know about Krishna, but without devotion, they're not connected to Krishna. Another piece of information. When their lives are completely disconnected from Krishna, and knowing Krishna, and loving Krishna, and being with Krishna, although they know they have some knowledge. So the essence is bhakti. Is that on target? Wait. Is that on target with your question? Okay. Yes.
Just trying to think on the point. So you need to have a little knowledge to engage in devotion.
Hmm? To have a little knowledge to engage?
It's like knowing Krishna doesn't help, but at least you should know that Krishna is the...
Yeah. This doesn't throw knowledge into the garbage bin. It's saying that knowledge on its own is not independent.
We read Bhagavad Gita. We're saying knowledge is not independent. But we're reading Bhagavad Gita. We have lots of books. Prabhupada gave us lots of books, but it's not just about knowledge. We say a book of transcendental knowledge, but it's not just about knowledge that's disconnected with bhakti. When we read Bhagavad Gita, it's nurturing bhakti, because the source is a bhakta. He's giving us bhakti. And connected with bhakti is knowledge and devotion. It's nourishing our bhakti. We're not gathering pieces of information, putting it into our information basket. Look at my information basket. Look at this. Zowie. How big is yours? It's not like that. Devotion. Our reading of Bhagavad Gita, our studying of Prabhupada's teachings and, you know, writings, it's nurturing bhakti. Without bhakti, it's the other kind. Oh, I learned this, and then I'm going to learn that, and then what's next? Material. Without bhakti. Yes.
Thank you very much for the wonderful connector flow of series of Maharaj. In that context, Maharaj, like if one has just bhakti in a case where won't Krishna provide the
of course
knowledge required?
Of course.
Oh.
Yes. You know the verse from the Bhagavatam? Can you quote the verse? First Canto, Chapter 2. Yeah. You know the verse? Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha. What's the rest? Janayati Ashu Vairagyam Gyanam Cha Yadahaitukam. When you engage in devotional service, ahaitukam, causelessly, there's knowledge. There's detachment arising from bhakti itself. And there's so many nice examples of that. So many nice examples of that. Yes?
You read about the body. How much place exercise and those things are in the process of devotion.
Well, Prabhupada exercised. You know, it was a certain kind of exercise. He didn't go to, you know, golden gym and lift weights. He didn't do that kind. But, you know, exercise. It's a natural part of health. And health helps service. Devotees that don't have good health, it's really frustrating. They can't do service. Poor Bhadra Narayan Maharaj, he likes service. He can't do service. Whew, frustrating. Anyway. So, for the purpose of balance, of good health, something. And different persons are different. It's right in Bhagavad Gita, you know, moderation. Not too much, not too little, that's what moderation is. Some. Not too much, not too little. For the purpose of health, maintaining strong, healthy body. One of the, say, the flip side, one of the common, not necessarily universal, but common causes of ill health is people don't exercise. And if, you know, if a physician an Ayurvedic physician gives a remedy. It's the medicine, diet, and exercise. Not just medicine and diet, some exercise. Without details. Depends on, you know, the circumstance, the body type, and what's not working right, and so something. Yes?
From the philosophical point of view, the Yoga Mishra Bhakti.
Yoga what?
Yoga Mishra Bhakti.
Yoga Mishra Bhakti.
And the physical exercise part of the yoga that we do in the, if we are practicing devotional service, the difference is in the goal, or what's the difference? Because you mentioned that Yoga Mishra
Yes, Bhakti is the consciousness goal. Behind the activity. That's the difference.
So Yoga Mishra Bhakti will also bring us to pure devotional service?
Yes. Well, it depends on, you know, are you instructed to do so or not? And, you know, yeah. It also depends on one's faith. Jagannath Das Babaji, for example, he lived for 140 years. We don't hear that he did yoga to live 140 years. And he was, a very rich, strong 140 years. He wasn't just like, you know, this feeble-minded, you know, fuddy-duddy. Lived 140 years. He ate, you know, some weird something. Anyway. Each body is different, each person is different. So I don't want to walk into that thing of, you know, you should do this and don't do that. Different persons are different. Anything else? No? Yes. Tapaloka. You want to go there? It's for brahmacharis only.
Is there any point where they also will go to Goloka Maharaj? Like some saturation point, like they'll be meditating on Madan Mohan, but where the point where they can directly go from Tapaloka to...
Well, it depends on bhakti. That's the operative principle. It's not whether they can or can't. It's dependent upon bhakti. And that depends on association.
It's like same kind of setting up here will be there in Tapaloka.
Is this going to help you go back to Godhead, this question? Or is this a curiosity question?
Out of curiosity.
Oh, okay. I think it's time for prasadam. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.